Accession number 9227, Reel 2.
Mr. Brown, Reel 2. I think you were describing the mobile artillery outfit in Hong Kong.
Yes, this was an Indian unit. It was a Singapore-Hong Kong Royal Artillery. And it was mobile. I'm afraid I can't remember the caliber of the guns, but they were mule packs. They were transportable by mule.
Would they have been 3.7 howitzers?
I'm ashamed to say I can't really remember. Yes, I really can't. And there was, of course, the Hong Kong Volunteer Defence Force, which was... there was an artillery section of it, a battery. There was also infantry, and they had various sections. They had Eurasian section. They had even a section comprising Scandinavians, Norwegians and Danes, of whom there were many in the island, and they formed their own section. They were part of an artillery section, they were helped to man the guns at Stanley. They were out there. I think there were 16-inch guns that were at Stanley, so they were attached to almost regular army units. But they had their own colonel who organized it all.
When did you join the Hong Kong Defence Force?
Well, now, it was clear that things, because of the continual rundown of the garrison, in their kind of war plan, if war did break out, it was clearly they would want every available person. I could see no point in my sitting down, scribbling, examining vouchers and things like that, or opponent's thoughts. So I asked whether there was any job which we could do. They first of all said, right, we will form you as a headquarters defence force. We were working in headquarters of Hong Kong, which was just above Kennedy, just below Kennedy Road, overlooking the harbour. And so we were given some training in the use of 303 rifle and the 38 revolver. That was our basic military training. And then they said, would I take on the job of a staff captain Q? Because at least I knew the whole of the army method of administration. I knew all the army depots, locations, and so on. And I would therefore be able, in time of trouble, to help assist units in Q matters, and be a liaison officer between headquarters and units. So I was put on to what was called the Regular Army Reserve of Officers as lieutenant. During the next, I think that was about 2 years, that must have been in 1940. I must have been about some of that. Because I... went on, we used to have maneuvers, so-called, about twice a year. And during those times, I used to go doing my duties round the island. There was a major RESC, Major Boone, I'm afraid of infamous name. I used to go round with him with units in their wartime stations, just seeing what queue problems there were and sorting that out. So I suppose in 1940 it would be. Some other members of our staff, Major Clark, he was my boss, he was a higher executive officer, he would be quite ranked as major. He went to the RSC, as did another one of ours. And so the small unit, we have about five, we had jobs allocated really, if war broke out, that we would take up. We couldn't just sit and do nothing. So that was how we came to be in the force. I reckon that was about middle of 1940.
You mentioned your military training in the 303 and the revolver. How long did they spend actually training you?
Oh, this was a period of evenings over a period of about a month, that was all. We just went up to the ranges in the evenings about twice a week to do this... firing in the range.
Did it go beyond range firing?
No, no.
You never. Did no minor tactics or anything
no,
like that?
No, nothing at all. No, no, no. There was nothing at all of that. The... I'm just trying to think of anything significant about our work. Yes, during this period, one of my jobs I found when I arrived there was I was given the job of maintaining the details of evacuation for military personnel. The military realized that there could come a time when there would be imminent, that the war would come or the Japanese would come over, and therefore one would wish to get the service families away quickly. And I think it was towards the end of 1940, there was a view that attack was imminent. And the instructions were to implement evacuation of all service families and Hong Kong's service families too, Hong Kong government service families. When I took this job over, I found I had a lot of files, a lot of bits of paper lying around, and I thought, well, what will happen when it happens? There's been no time to sort out and document people. If we're going to make it at all, it will have to be done now. So over the next few months after that, I used to spend time in the evenings, and I recorded on tickets every woman and child who was known to be in the services on the island at that time. And I put them into various sections, which there had to be, and I kept these dockets up to date. In other words, when families left and people came, they came. When the order came to evacuate, it really was a matter of 2 days. The families were going. The families assembled in Kowloon, and it was very gratifying to be able to straight away, when they came, to tell the name, to issue their dockets, which they had to put on the children and they had to put on themselves. And in fact, the whole thing really worked beautifully. We had lists, the thing, and they were all put on one ship and sent off to Manila. Now, the civilian families, really by the time the military families were going, there was a doubt as to whether anything was really going to happen. And so the Hong Kong government virtually dropped any idea of evacuating its families. But the military were determined that nothing would stop them, they were going. So they were sent off to Manila. Now, the army could not send military personnel at that time to Manila because America wasn't at war, and it was difficult for military personnel, therefore, to be acting in Manila. So they came to the head of my, who was a financial advisor, and said, look, you are a representative of the War Office. You are a civilian. Will you please go to Manila with the families and see exactly what happens to them? He wanted to take me, but then he said, no, Brown, he said, you're too young. I'll take Hubbard, whose wife was also on board. And so they set off, and they went to Manila. They found, when they got there, the conditions were appalling because the families were scattered over the whole area around Manila and up in the hills. Some were even in brothels. You know, the accommodation. Very little was done for them. And so Hubbard and Kilpatrick spent about the next fortnight trying to sort out, I mean, the families were just spread all over the place, where they were, and so on. And then it was decided that I think they were put there originally as a holding, whether or not they would go on or come back. And it was then decided that there was no way of bringing them back to Hong Kong. They must go on. And so a ship was got to take them to Australia. And again, it was chaos. The American authorities weren't particularly helpful. But Kilpatrick and Hubbard, together with help, managed to arrange for all the families to be collected from all their various places. Some had to come by train from up in the hills and so on, down to the ship. And, of course, on the ship, there was then pandemonium because the ship was not really big enough. Families of all ranks and grades and children. And the ship's officers hadn't got a clue how to cope with this vast influx. And so Kilpatrick, in desperation, said, Hubbard, you've got to go. And so poor old Bert Hubbard found himself on board. And he told me afterwards it really was chaos. there were women who considered themselves, you know, very important, therefore entitled to a cabin on their own. Clearly wasn't that. And so eventually Hubbard and the purser and some of the women began to sort things out. Those women who were obviously clearly very pregnant. I mean, one came up to Hubbard and said, I'm 8 months gone. Hubbard, what are you going to do about it? sorted them out. Some had to sleep on decks down below. Children had to be sorted out. And so they went to Australia. And of course, once they got to Australia, they had to decide where they wanted to go. So some said they wanted to go to Melbourne, some wanted to go to Sydney. So they then again found that the families were landed. Then how to keep in touch with them, how to maintain them, because, I mean, they had no visible means of support. And so again, poor old Hubbard found himself whisked into Canberra and made a liaison officer for the service families in Australia. And he stayed there for the whole of 1941. And my boss was getting very cross, saying, look, I'm short of a man. Hubbard isn't there for this job. And the War Office, the Australians, saying, we can't let him go. He's too valuable. And in the end, the War Office won the day. And poor old Bert Hubbard came back to Hong Kong and arrived back in November 1941, just before the outbreak of war. But that was the evacuation of the military families. The civilian families stayed, and there was no impetus at all. Some, in fact, did go. And then, as 1940 went to 41, a lot came back. And but the services refused to allow any service families to back. There was no question of that at all. Once they'd gone, they went. The
did that have any effect on the morale of the soldiers?
Of course, I was a bachelor. I wasn't really aware of it. I was very conscious that there were no girls around. One led a very monastic life in those days because the female things were very small. But I think there was enough in Hong Kong in the short term for interest. The men had servants to, if they were in quarters, they lived in their quarters and they had servants to see to what they wanted. Clearly, I mean, people miss their families. But I'm not aware that, you know, there was a great loss of morale. But then perhaps I'm not the right person to talk to because, I say, I was a bachelor and I only saw it from the point of view that there were very few women around or girls around. But I say, my hobby was sailing and therefore I was out on the water all the time as I could. I was in 1941, it was decided to begin reinforcing Hong Kong, to build up Hong Kong, because by that time I think they felt there were resources spare, and therefore they decided to send two Canadian battalions out to reinforce the garrison. And they arrived, I recollection, somewhere about September, October 41, and really it was pathetic. Because they, the Royal Rifles of Canada and the Winnipeg Grenadiers, and they'd been on guard duties in the Canada. They'd had very little military service training. And they arrived as green as anybody could be. In uniform, tough, spoke tough. You know, let's see those nips and we're going to chase them over the hills. And the whole defense plan of Hong Kong was changed. The Middlesex were a mainland battalion, and they were withdrawn to the island. And they kept, they put two Canadian battalions one Canadian battalion on the mainland, one Canadian battalion on the island, and they put the Royal Scots, who I think have been a mainland battalion before, and two Indian regiments on this defence line. So the result was only some 6 weeks before the bloom went up. All the units, virtually in the island, were in different positions to what they had been trained in and used to.
I'd like to ask you a bit more about the gin drinkers' line. Yes. You mentioned being a naturally strong position. Now, the plans for strengthening it, did they involve using a lot of concrete and steel reinforcements and that sort of thing?
Yes, yes, yes. It was engineer work which was wanted, yes. Yes, engineering. And guns, I think, too. Artillery. Because there was very little artillery other than on Stanley, which was the seaward defence. Apart from the mobile artillery, there was virtually nothing else.
Was it intended to have a continuous line of entrenchment on this?
I wouldn't have said it was entrenchment. I would have said it would have been a continuous line of emplacements. Because it's a fairly steep, rugged line. I mean, it's quite... It really is. I mean, when you leave Kai Tak, flying out of an aircraft used to be in the old days dangerous because you had this great ridge of hills going across the line. And then it came down to the new territories, which were almost flat right to the frontier. So it was a natural boundary running right across.
What was actually accomplished in strengthening that line then?
What would have been?
What was accomplished? What was? Were any emplacements actually built and were guns installed?
No guns were installed, no. There were some, the work hadn't really started. The plans were there, but the work hadn't really been started when the war broke out.
And that was due purely to a lack of money?
Due to the fact that there was no finances, yes. The money, there was none at all. It was kept short, as one can understand.
Were there any more conventional field works on the line? Did troops dig pits and bunkers there?
I'm not aware that there were. I'm not aware. I'm aware that there were emplacements and kind of places behind the emplacements for troops who happened to be stationed in that particular part of the line. But then, of course, you've got to remember that we had two more battalions and they were added to that line. And so it was all very makeshift. They presumably must have dug some emplacements up there. But the Canadians really had no idea of war at all. They really were green. I mean, they really were. As I discovered, because shortly after I arrived, I went round the island and to see these chaps who were now in their new positions in the island. And they really hadn't a clue of... they spoke big. I mean, you know, they said, "Well, you know, these little nips, they'll run." But you had to tell them about supplies. You had to, even the food, even the rations, they weren't really happy about. So it was a case of mollycoddling them, really, almost educating them into a way of life which was so foreign to them. And, of course, they were then out in their kind of wartime positions by this time. And so they needed guidance, they needed help. And this is one of the things that one was able to do, because this is our thing. Things like laundry, for example, washing clothes and things like that. We used to have contracts for what we call Dobie Wallers to arrange for washing. In that climate, in the summer particularly. Clean clothes, washing clothes is almost an essential thing. And so we had laundry contracts and contracts of all kinds arranged for units, conservancies, scavenging, things like that. And the way units couldn't live except in those days without having all these facilities provided for them. And these were all a matter of contracts, which again our office arranged and audited. My job was on cash audit, and so I knew all the where the money was going and what it was going on, and food and supplies. The Navy was there. It had very little. It had some old gunboats which had come down from the waterways, Shanghai. It had a flotilla of MTBs, and the RAF. Well, had virtually no aircraft at all. And
what types of aircraft did they have?
I'm just trying to think of them. They were, I didn't think they were gladiators, but prior to that time, I think they had about six aircraft. Very, very ancient, very old ones.
Was there any anti-aircraft defence?
Yes, there was. Yes, we had an anti-aircraft defence batteries. And the Hong Kong volunteers, I'm sorry, yes, manned those two. They were scattered around the island. And there were some mobile ones too, but not much.
Were there any preparations for air raid precautions for the civil populace?
I'm not aware of any. I'm not aware that there were any at all. There were no shelters. None at all. All that was, I knew you, was they built a battle headquarters defence headquarters. The ordinary headquarters was above ground, just below Kennedy Road. And when I went out, there, it had already been constructed. And this was a vast underground headquarters underneath the peacetime headquarters, which looked out, which in fact faced on a, was on a slope leading down, looking out over the harbour. And this was very close to the harbour. In fact, the back entrance of it went out into DeVoe Road, which ran parallel to the harbour. And so that existed, but that's the only, as far as I knew, the only area shelter there was. And that was for the battle headquarters.
How large would the battle headquarters be? How many officers and men would you have in it?
The whole of the headquarters, probably of the order of 100, with clerks and things like that. So probably something of the order of 200 people, I suppose, that order.
How large was the Hong Kong Defence Force in terms of battalions?
There again, I can't really say. I think one of these books, I think, would give some idea of the battalions, if I could have a reference later on. But I think Hubbard's notes did give all the units in Hong Kong, and I could probably run through those quickly and give you a resume of them later on, if you like, or you can get them from those.
But the basic garrison was the four regular battalions, wasn't it? The Middlesex.
Four regular battalions, yes, and the two Canadians, plus yes. The two Canadians, yes.
So the Rajputs and the Punjabis, the Royal Scots and the Middlesex, and then there were the two newly arrived Canadian
battalions. Yes, right, yes.
Battalions.
With the HKVDC and the mobile artillery.
Going on from air raid precautions, you said there were no shelters. Were there any plans for emergency fire services?
Again, I'm not aware of any. Not aware of any. But then I there may have been in the civil population, but I may not have known about it. But I wasn't aware of any, and nor did I really see any in action.
Did the Hong Kong police have a war role?
That I don't know either. I'm not aware that they were given any specific duties. A lot of them, of course, came in the volunteers. They were in the volunteers rather than being in the police.
What was the relationship like between the police and the army in Hong Kong?
Oh, very good, because it was mainly European. And as I said, my friends were cadets in the police force, cadets in the Hong Kong in the Hong Kong government. Oh no, the relationship was very good. There was no problem there at all.
Apart from the shortage of engineering stores for constructing the yes. Gin Drinkers Line.
Yes.
Were there any other important shortages from which the army suffered?
Well, manpower, I think. Ammunition had been scarce, but I think supplies came in 41. This was another thing that I think was kept short, particularly for artillery. But I think supplies came into 41 and stocked it up. Lack of aircraft, I think, was realised to be the great thing. I think we all realised we were just hostages to fortune. I don't think any of us realised, thought that there was any way out of this. We were there, and when war with Bloom went up, we couldn't see possibly, however, any assistance could get to us at all. And I think it was lack of air power, and of course there was no sea power at all in the air at that time.
You said there was a scare in 1940, and that
yes.
precipitated the
yes.
evacuation of service yes. families. What was it that caused that scare?
That I don't know. All I can assume for intelligence, whether they detected movements of Japanese forces on the border, or the Chinese intelligence had reported movements, I don't know. I can't recollect if I was even told about it. But certainly there was a thought that it was imminent. Action by the Japanese was imminent.
Were you closely in touch with what was going on the mainland in China as a whole?
Yes, we had news. I think headquarters used to have bulletins published fairly frequently of the situation in China generally, of the nationalist troops and the Japanese. In fact, I mean, very close to it. One of my jobs, strange enough, was assessing the rate of exchange for the services. We used to get details from banks periodically, from the banks as to the current rate of exchange and what the dollar the Singapore and, and also to, not the Sing, Singapore, the Hong Kong and the Shanghai dollar. Because when I first went there, we had small garrisons up in the north, in places like Wei Hai Wei and Tsingtao, and in Shanghai. And I had hoped to get up there because I was intensely wanted to get into China. But it just been my bad luck that they withdrew the garrisons from there sometime, I think it was 1940. But I was also responsible for the assessing the rate of exchange for the Shanghai dollar. And, of course, before we evacuated, the Shanghai dollar was going down so fast that it was almost difficult to apply a rate. But, no, I used to have to assess the what the bank provided and say, well, this is what it ought to be, and that would be published and signaled to Singapore, to Shanghai, or to Hong Kong, and that was the rate which British personnel had their pounds converted into local dollars. So we were well aware of what was going on.
Did you regard it as inevitable that there would be war with Japan?
Those as there were, yes, we did, yes. It was only, I think, a question of time.
Was that the case when you arrived in 1939? Was it already considered inevitable then?
I'm not so sure then. No, I don't think so. I don't think it was so then. They were there, but it was felt that they wouldn't wish to take on the might of Britain. I think the Japanese were seriously underrated. The propaganda was wrong. We were told that Japanese didn't like fighting at night. Didn't see particularly well in the dark, so they didn't fight at night. And there were lots of silly things like this to virtually write down the Japanese effort. They were ragged, bare-assed soldiers who just didn't know how to conduct a proper campaign. But nonetheless, there they were over the whole of China. Anyway, I mean, one had to just see it to realise that, this was just propaganda.
When was it then that you decided that a war with Japan was inevitable?
I think led towards the end of 1940 when we evacuated the families. Then I think one realised that it was touch and go. Any time now that there could be something could happen.
Was it that evacuation of the families, was it anything that had happened elsewhere that convinced people that the war was on and that it couldn't be avoided?
I don't think so. I think it was just a general feeling that, how could the Japanese army just squat all over the frontier, ring us round? And it was very boastful, of course, the Japanese people in those days. They were talking about this greater coast prosperity sphere over the Far East. They were pumping out a lot of propaganda. They were certainly spying in the colony. There's no question about that. They were everywhere. I remember going out once in my little yacht through Lai Moon, which is a small pass between the mainland and the island, and I had a Chinese boat boy who was to sail with me, and we passed a fishing boat, a little boat, and there was a chap fishing, and I thought it was a Chinese. My boat boy spat over the side. I said, what's that for? He said, it's Japanese. And he was just sitting beneath one of our batteries, taking notes of it. The Japanese had really infiltrated.